kind of
interview with Pat Callahan. How long have you lived in the Portland
metro
area?
May 15th.
May 15th.
2005.
Whatever.
11 or so. Go ahead.
30-ish. How long have you lived in the Portland metro area?
Since 1981. So, whatever that is, 24 years. And I lived in that area also for undergraduate work for 3 years before that.
Undergraduate work in what?
In, was it Lewis and Clark Law School, or excuse me, Lewis and Clark undergrad from 1974, so I graduated in 1977 with degrees in communications and political science.
And what is your job title now?
Senior Deputy District Attorney, Multnomah County.
What do you believe is the biggest problem in crime concerning the metro area?
Lack of jail space.
How often do you deal with criminals and/or law enforcement?
Every stinking day.
And how do you deal with them? What's your job?
I am one of the leaders of the felony person crimes unit. I prosecute sex crimes and felony assaults.
Okay. What kind of crimes do you see most often? Over the past 25 years, not just right now.
Oh, good on. Well, it all depends on your assignment. The current assignment I have, we see mostly assaults, felony assaults, assaults with dangerous or deadly weapons. We also see sex crimes, rape twos.
Are those often with dangerous weapons, or those?
No, most of the time it's actually most of the rapes and sex crimes, not all, but most of them are age, we'll call them age crimes. They're statutory offenses. They're underage, consensual but underage. Before that, I dealt for years with property crimes, stolen cars, thefts, forgeries, ID thefts. Before that, I dealt with robberies, burglaries. I pretty much covered everything in the 24 years I've been there.
Do you think more crime happens in Portland and the metro area than people think?
Oh, absolutely. I think it's always people like grand jurors get an eye-opening experience when they sit on a grand jury and hear about all the crime that happens in Portland. Because most of us sit in our discreet little neighborhoods and we don't understand. Maybe our car gets broken into once every couple of years, but you don't have a clue.
How often do you think the wrong guy is caught or someone is not convicted or something like that in the Portland metro area?
Well, those are two very different questions. Okay. How often is the wrong guy caught? They may catch the wrong guy, but usually the police are very quick to identify that because they'll show it to somebody and they'll say, no, that's not him. Or the guy will give them an explanation and they'll understand that they've got the wrong guy. How often is a person not caught? That happens all the time.
I meant like convicted. So what if the wrong guy is caught and he's not convicted? Do you ever have like two trials with the same case? Does that happen very often?
Never. I'd say never. In other words, it's like O.J., right? You know, O.J. was not convicted, but they had the right guy. So they're never going to try somebody else for those murders. Because O.J. did it. He just got off. Now, that's a national example. What about around here? The fact of the matter is that nobody takes a case to trial if they don't believe that they have the right person. So if a person is acquitted of that charge, in 24 years, I've never seen somebody get acquitted and then us go back and, oh, oops, we had the wrong guy, let's go after someone else.
Do you think that's different than in other bigger cities like New York or L.A.?
Well, there's certainly been a history of problems in, for instance, Chicago. Chicago had a history of bad police work, where they would basically beat confessions out of people, force confessions out of people. We just haven't had, it's not our history, put it that way.
How often do you see crimes being committed, or just crime in general, outside of your work?
I think I'm more vigilant, so I see stuff that maybe other people don't see. But, you know, my car's been broken into, our tires have been slashed. But I also, I keep my eyes open, and I see stuff that other people might not see. I see hookers, you know, I see dopers, I see drug deals going on the street that other people might miss.
So you think that's just your experience dealing with the criminals? You know their movements and attitudes?
That's probably, I don't know that I know their movements, but I see sketchy people and I watch them and I have some experience, so I know what's going on. I mean, people may be shaking hands to someone else, but I know they're actually making a deal.
What is one of the biggest differences, or some of the differences, that you've seen in crime and law enforcement in the past 25 years?
Crime and law enforcement. Well, probably the biggest change in crime has been the use of computers and, you know, just your basic technical things that that computers give criminals access to. The surge in identity theft, for instance, people manufacturing computers, credit cards, excuse me, and identification and phony checks through computers is a huge difference. You know, I think the biggest sort of false story about this huge meth epidemic, it's not that that's a false story, there is a huge amount of meth, but it's always been there, and meth has always been a huge part of the crime picture. It's just that it's more in the spotlight now, for whatever reason.
Is that happening with a lot of things?
Well, I don't know. I think that's just the biggest example lately.
Do you feel safer with the justice system today than you did 25 years ago?
Well, that's an interesting question. I'd say no. And I think the reason is that, I mean, when you think of the justice system, if you think of the justice system as just the courts, then am I safer? I don't know. I mean,
well, either the courts or the police. Or
well, see, that's where I think the justice system starts, with the police officers out on the street. I mean, that's what really community safety is all about, is the police officers out on the street. And I don't feel as safe as I did that long ago, because their budgets keep getting squeezed, and they keep losing officers, and they keep going doing ideas like, a particular chief will come in with ideas like community policing that I don't really think necessarily makes the city safer, because one of the things it does is it does have an idea. The idea is good, to put more officers out in the communities and interact in the community, but it typically, they have to fund that by taking money away from other parts of the department. Things like detectives, which is what detectives investigate. Detectives put cases together. Detectives put bad criminals away by their good police work. But it's going to be missed by some cop who's just out walking the street.
Are DARE officers and officers that hang out at schools, are they counted as community law enforcement?
Well, sure, that's a community effort, you know, and there's always a question as to how productive those efforts are. You know, is a DARE officer in the school going to actually stop kids from using drugs? I don't know the answer to that. I think it's a worthy effort.
Do you see more criminals that are minors or more adults?
How do you mean? I mean, I saw a lot of minors when I was the head of the juvenile section, and I see minors now because of ballot measure 11. I see people, 15, 16, 17, who are charged with very serious offenses, and they're treated in the adult system. If you mean overall, do I see more crooks? It's hard to say. A percentage of the population, I can't give you. There's plenty of crime to go around, and there's never been a shortage.
What about the rest of the demographics as far as criminals and victims or law enforcers? Are most of the criminals black while law enforcers are white, or?
Well, I don't think there's any question but that there's no question that law enforcement is primarily white. There's an effort, for instance, by the Portland Police Bureau, to try and recruit minorities. And there's certainly an overrepresentation of blacks in the corrections population.
By overrepresentation, you mean
percentage?
A bigger percentage,
right? And the same is true of Hispanics. There's an overrepresentation in the prison population, but that doesn't necessarily mean that. I think that some people would then jump to the conclusion that because the police are white, they look for black people committing crimes. And I think that that's too simplistic. I think that the fact of the matter is that you have to, in the black community, in the Hispanic community, there are more crimes committed, period. Socioeconomically, the same is true in, parts of Southeast Portland that are white as can be. There's more crimes committed because of the lower socioeconomic, drug houses are, that's where drug people hang out. You could have saturation patrols in Dunthorpe that aren't going to come up with any people being arrested because of the socioeconomic strata. That's why we have, more officers in the lower socioeconomic areas.
So you think in poorer communities more crime happens? Or
yeah,
is it just different
yeah.
types of crime? Or
well,
just any
it's
type
more
of crime?
Obvious crime, and yes, I think in poorer communities, because you got people who aren't working, you got people who are working at jobs that they can't make ends meet. There is a Well, there's all kinds of reasons that go together, but, you know, when people are desperate, people commit crime.
How often do you think suburban crimes find their way to downtown courts?
Well, suburban crimes, I mean, you know, hey, the suburbs, they get burglarized, people break into houses. If you mean suburbanites, i.e., you know, the people who you would ordinarily not think of as being the crooks, occasionally they do. We see those a lot when we go after embezzlers, you know, economic crimes, that sort of things. Because it's those people who are in a position to steal from companies, you know, the bookkeepers, the payroll people, the white collar kind of workers are in that kind of position to embezzle from a company.
Do you think more crime happens in a downtown area other than like outskirts of the city or town?
Well, it all depends. You know, if the outskirts of the city were where, you know, the bad area of town, if that's what you want to say, then I'd say maybe not, you know. But downtown tends to draw quite a cross-section. It also tends to draw people who are looking for opportunities, whether they're panhandling or whether they're looking to break into cars. You know, there's a concentration of targets down there.
Do you believe people can truly be corrected and crime-free after they've gone through the jail systems?
Can be, yeah.
Do you think they are?
Oh, not. It's not the system that's going to do it. It has to be them. You know, it has to be an individual thing, and you just can't predict. You can have somebody who's the most, you know, hardened crook, who's been down a number of times, and maybe this time will do it. Actually, they'll go, okay, I've had it. That's enough. I'm going to make the change. You can have some new guy who's in there for the first time, and a term of incarceration does nothing. You know, and they just go back to it. So, I think it's... I've always said that if you're trying to get someone treatment, you know, I want to prosecute them so that they can get treatment, you know, the system does a bad job of that. It's very expensive, the system is short of money, and the system makes a lousy parent. You know, we can't make somebody do treatment, we can't make somebody benefit from treatment. They have to do that themselves.
How has your job changed in the past 24 years?
Well, part of it, of course, is the people that the cases have gotten bigger. You know, as you get more responsibility, you know, the cases get bigger. But it's really, I mean, there's little things that change. You know, the rules change, you know, cases come in and throw things into a tizzy, or the legislature changes the laws, or a ballot measure comes in, like ballot measure 11, that changes something, you know, big time. But the basic function is still the same. You know, I've always kind of viewed us as, you know, we're the good guys, we're on the white hats. Or wearing the white hats, riding the white horse, because we're protecting the community from the predators, and taking dangerous people off the streets. You know, that's a good thing.
How did Measure 11 change the system?
Well, it has had a number of impacts. I think the first that most people don't get is that it really has had an impact on the percentages of violent crimes. I mean, it has gone down since ballot measure 11. Ballot measure 11, I think, has returned some sort of real accountability, not just for crooks, but for the system, to the people. That is, people, after a while, they think that the system just gives people a slap on the wrist. Well, ballot measure 11 was an abrupt change from that. Now there are very certain consequences for certain activities, and they're substantial consequences. I mean, it's painful. So ballot measure 11 gives that back to the citizens. And, you know, there have been moves to try and weaken ballot measure 11 or to repeal it, and they have been wholeheartedly voted down by the people of the state of Oregon. You know, the citizens who are out there, unlike the some of our elected leaders who would like to think that you know, maybe we should be softer on this sort of thing. Most people out there go, no, lock those people up.
Have there been any other measures or legislation that have changed
well,
the
not
system so much?
Not that it had the impact, I don't think, of Measure 11. I mean, there's a legislative session every 2 years, and so the laws get changed. There are court decisions that change the way that we do things, and then the legislature reacts to that. But I would say that ballot measure 11 is probably the biggest thing.
Are there any cases that come to mind that have changed the way law enforcement has viewed everything in the Portland metro area or anything like that?
No. You mean local type cases or
mm-hmm.
national cases?
Local type cases.
No, I just, every case that catches the headlines, you know, just gives you a snapshot of a particular, you know, sad story, you know. And those sad stories happen all the time. You know, you might think about the shootings, the police shootings. You know, those have certainly had an impact. And they have made a difference in that I think there's more there's more review, there's more oversight of police activities.
How did Rodney King and the LA riots affect your job? Or did it?
Well, once again, I think that kind of ties into the Portland police shootings. I mean, I think that the Rodney King videos, it shows the problems with a short attention span. You know, I mean, we see the video highlights of Rodney King getting beaten, but in fact, you know, the video was many minutes long, and when the jurors actually saw the whole thing, you know, it presents a very different picture. So, but the highlights that you see are very inflammatory. So I think really what the Rodney King did is to show the power of the media to change people's thinking. You know, I mean, most people who saw that just think that the police were beating him for no reason, when in fact there was some, whether it was justifiable or not, there was a lot that went on before that that led to that. And so it seems to me to just show the power of the media to affect people's thinking in an inaccurate way.
Are there any particular instances or cases that you've worked on that are remarkable to you?
Yeah, I mean, all the big cases that you work on are remarkable. You know, they're remarkable to me. I don't know if they're remarkable to the community, you know, because I'm just one prosecutor in an office of 70 plus, and, you know, there's hundreds of prosecutors across the state, and we all have our cases. But I think some of them that you do, they leave a personal mark on you, either because of the people that are involved or the intensity of the case.
Yeah. Can you share any of the cases?
Well, I had a case that I tried with another guy from our office, of a man who killed two people. And he's now sitting on death row, and that is a significant case to me. There aren't, you know, it's funny, is that an accomplishment? I don't know that it's an accomplishment. I mean, I'm just doing my job, but I'm enforcing the laws that the people of the state of Oregon enacted. You know, they passed the death penalty for certain crimes. They said that, you know, if you commit these crimes, then you are potentially subject to the death penalty. This guy committed those crimes, and he was convicted of those crimes, and he was sentenced and given the ultimate sentence. I feel good about that because it's difficult to obtain that measure of justice. You know, whether he'll ever be executed is another question. But the fact of the matter is, I'm just very happy he's off the street so that he's not able to do that to somebody else.
How has your job affected your family and social life?
Oh, I think it's affected it a lot. Because I think I'm more vigilant. I think I was very protective of my kids when they were small. I think perhaps I passed on some of my cynicism to my kids.
No.
it's when you deal with the kind of people we deal with all the time, it's hard to have a rosy, sort of cheery, I'll call it naive, outlook on the basic human nature. And so you are suspicious of people's motives. And I'm sure that affected my relationships with my family. I have most of my good friends, many of my good friends are friends from work. You know, some people think that that's not healthy. You need to have friends outside of your work, and I agree with that. But I work with some great people. I'm very happy that they're friends of mine. But I think, too, when you associate with people who are dealing with the same stuff and having to deal with it in similar ways, that also affects you and what you present to people outside of that circle.
Do Do you think you and your family are more hardened to crime? Like what you see in movies or something like that, does it not have as great of an impact or shock factor?
Well, I know, yes, I think that's probably true. I know it is for me. I mean, you know, I've seen a lot of dead bodies and been to a lot of autopsies. You know, not the sort of thing I expected when I was in college. I've seen a lot of man's inhumanity to man. I think we're hardened to it. You have to develop a kind of a thick skin.
If you become aware of criminal actions or anything like that, are you obligated to report it?
Well, I think it all depends. For instance, if we do have mandatory reporting of child abuse, I'm speaking as an attorney. We are legally required to report to law enforcement or to child protection services when we see child abuse. If you're asking, are you as a citizen required, if you see a crime, you know, to report it? There are legal obligations. For instance, if you're a witness to an accident, you are supposed to stop and give information so that you can be relied upon as a witness. But the law doesn't, I mean, if you see somebody shoplifting a roast at the store, you don't have a legal obligation to report that. I think you have a moral obligation, but not a legal obligation.
Do you think in general, over the past 25 years, people are more hardened to crime?
Well, certainly exposure to movies and TV shows, I'd say they are more aware of crime. But when I meet people who are the victims of crimes, when they actually have it visited upon them, I don't know that having watched a bunch of movies about it has hardened them to the actual effects. I think sometimes we're sort of inured to it by the constant exposure. But when it actually happens to you, it still hits you.
Have you yourself ever been a victim of any crimes?
Not serious crimes.
As you said before, tires lashes
right.
And stuff
yeah.
Like that. How do you cope with your job? You know, you have a great amount of responsibility to the people that you're, like, the victims and then the people that you're prosecuting.
I don't have a simple answer for that. You just have to deal with it. I think one of the things that I do is I just try and... Humor is very important. I think it's very important to have a good sense of humor. And, you know, we make a lot of sick jokes about... You just kind of have to laugh about it because so many of these things are so awful. And it might seem, probably would seem callous to someone just looking in from the outside, but you know, that's one of the ways we deal with it. You know, I mean, you're standing around an autopsy table and some poor person who's had some horrible thing done to them, and you're having to watch that process, you know, you gotta deal with it somehow.
Why are you as a lawyer required to be at autopsies and such?
Well, required is certainly not legally required, but
yeah,
our practice is that when you're assigned to a homicide, you go to the autopsy. Just like you should, I mean, if you're assigned to prosecute a crime, don't you think you ought to go to the crime scene and see what it looks like? Well, it's the same kind of thinking. You want to be there, I think, on two levels you want to be there. Number one, you want to be there technically to see what's done, to see the path of the knife wound or the path of a bullet, or to find the to be there when they determine the mechanism of the death. On the second level is more of an emotional one, in that I think you become, perhaps you cannot help but become more invested in the case when you see that process.
What do you think main motives for crimes, violent crimes, are today?
Well, they're all, I think they're the traditional I mean, it's interesting. Motives imply something that's thought out.
Do you think a lot of them aren't thought out?
Oh, absolutely. Many crimes are spontaneous. Most of the assaults that we have are spontaneous. They're just drunken or high idiots reacting.
You think that's the same for murders?
Often.
Wow.
Often.
Do you think that's changed in the past 24 years?
Not necessarily. I mean, there's a... You know, the whole... The TV show murders, where somebody has, you know, in a calculated way, come to this, you know, decision, I'm going to kill this person, and they set everything up, and they did. Those just don't happen very often. They very rarely happen. It's usually a, in a fit of jealous rage, you know, I mean, or a drunken rage, or both.
So you think it's usually emotional and not, oh, he has $2 million or something?
Absolutely. Or, you know, your pride gets challenged, and so and that's the way people deal with it. You know, you get into a fist fight and somebody pulls a knife. I've had a number of killings in bars, where, you know, people get into a fight at a bar, and then, you know, one guy leaves, and, you know, it's either going to all be fine, or that guy's going to come back with a gun. And he kills somebody. That's what happens.
How big of a problem do you think gangs are in Oregon and the Portland metro area?
Well, they're a problem. They ebb and flow like other things. I mean, I think in the last year, they've really started to come back a little bit. You know, perhaps the two or three years before that, we'd seen a downswing. But in some ways, they're a constant. You know, I mean, the Hispanic gangs have been a lot more prominent lately. We don't see a lot of the Asian gangs, but they're still out there, and kind of the same with the black gangs, we still see them. But there was an effort, gosh, it's been a number of years ago now, where our office brought a RICO action against a number of gangbangers. And were very successful and got some very lengthy prison sentences.
What are RICO actions?
RICO is racketeering, influenced, and corrupt organizations is what RICO, RICO, stands for. And it's a mechanism, it's a law. You can bring charges involving RICO when there is a pattern of an organization with of criminal activities. And it's a very potent tool. It's very difficult to use, but I think that kind of lopped the head off of not all the gang problem, but a major part of it back, whatever this was, 10 years ago or so. But there's always, people coming up. Just like, I'm prosecuting the children of people I prosecuted 24 years ago. So there's a never-ending supply.
Do you see any Caucasian gangs?
They're there. Many of these are pretty loosely structured. We have the skinhead gangs, the white power sort of people, but they're pretty small in number. We also have, Caucasians who join black gangs. I don't know that we've had very many Hispanic gangs or Asian gangs. But, they're there, just not as prominent.
When was RICO developed?
Well, it's been on the books for probably, here in Oregon, I guess, about 15 years. I could look it up in the statute, but I don't have my books here. It's been there. It's just, it isn't used very much.
Is there any other major differences or anything you'd like to share about the changes in crime and law enforcement in the past 25 years?
Of course, I think that I mentioned earlier that maybe one of the big changes with courts had to do with computers. The law enforcement side has to try and, we always seem to be a step behind. There's a great need for additional computer forensics work. Everybody seems now, because of the current hit TV shows of CSI and that sort of thing, to be into the whole forensics scientific stuff, which I think is greatly overblown. The fact of the matter is that people don't leave fingerprints on everything, and DNA is great, but some of the stuff they do is it's TV. But there's a great need for computer forensics because so many crimes have evidence on computers, the computer is the instrumentality used to commit the crime. We see it a lot in the economic crimes, whether they're cooking checks on their computers or building IDs, or whether they're using them to commit the crimes. We also see it in child porn cases. We see them in other sex offenses because they store video images and that sort of thing. And the police have had to develop that expertise. And it's, again, they always seem to be a day late and a dollar short. We don't have enough people. We don't have enough facilities. And so they're all backed up.
How effective do you think composites are?
In 24 years, I don't think I've ever had a composite that, in one of my cases. But it all depends on the circumstances. Many of these cases are solved pretty quickly. They know who did it. Now, some of them aren't. But in many of the cases, you don't necessarily have eyewitnesses who are capable of doing the composite. I have seen some composites in cases that other people have had that have been very helpful, and they're very close. A lot of it depends on the artist and, of course, how good your witness is in recreating that. You know, when you only have a minute or two to see somebody's face, how accurate is your recollection? How good is your recollection? Some people are really good at that. Some people aren't.
Okay, are there any other last stories or anything?
Okay.